Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pop-Up Poets series. I'm going to be giving a lecture in front of this lovely piece here. My name is Brent Cunningham. I have a lot of friends here, I see. Thank you for coming. It's a pretty brief lecture. This is something that they've been doing in the MoMA all summer, and I'd like to thank Suzanne Stein and Samantha Giles for helping set it up. It takes about 25 minutes, and I'm going to try to hustle through it. A lot of them this summer that they've been doing have been very poetic. So these poets standing in front of an art piece talking about it, and a lot of the pieces have been very poetic in the sense of sort of oblique, suggestive, or non-discursive. But mine's a pretty straight-ahead lecture just to prepare you. I'm a kind of a wannabe academic, and I like to practice explaining, so it's fairly straightforward, I think, and it's actually got a title. It's called Number, Visual Art, and Writing. I want to basically take a look at the way numbers, mathematics, works, or operates inside of literature, inside of visual art, and a lot of these examples I'm going to use are going to come from poetry or the history of writing. Since these are the arts that I know the most about, I think that probably everybody here is more sophisticated than the norm about some of these issues and questions, but I do think that the stark division in our culture between the hard sciences and the soft sciences, which is a categorical division that we're, I think, all used to, but it's a division of labor as well as being a practical, conceptual division of labor. And I want to just trouble it a little bit and ask some questions about it and see if we can think harder about how number and art and writing interact. Part of it is because I do happen to do the numbers at my job. I work at a literary organization in Berkeley, and I guess you could say I'm probably the poet on a staff of poets who's, I guess you say, least abysmal at numbers. And so as a result, my job involves numbers and mathematics a lot. And so that's probably the source of my interest. But I'm going to talk about the piece just a little bit, since you're going to theoretically be staring at it for the next 20 minutes. The artist's name is Hannah Darboven. Her dates are 1941 to 2009. Her father was a successful businessman, which is something that she shares in common with my background. My dad was also a successful businessman, although hers was far, far more successful. Apparently, you ask. There was someone looking at this piece who was like, oh, Darboven, right, and was thinking of her father, who I think has some products that might even be named after him. But anyway, she was a very private person generally, and not overtly political, and there's not really a lot of information about her in English, although I think there's probably more in German, which I don't speak. She's often called a conceptual artist, and she gets lumped in with that group of folks in the in New York in the 60s and 70s. Around Sol LeWitt, people like Mel Bochner, who she knew, and maybe more widely, you can think of like Eva Hesse and Robert Smithson. So sort of that minimalist, late minimalist, conceptual complex of artists in that period. And I was talking earlier this summer with David Book, a friend of some of ours here, he had the feeling that one thing that knits together that group, maybe not always, but one thing that knits them together is serialism and serial repetitions of various kinds. And I think you can really see it in this piece very starkly. It's a number series without any question. The piece is called 51 Drawings, and I'm going to save you the time of counting the pieces and tell you there are actually 50 pieces here. So theoretically, maybe the entire piece is the 51st. And I think that in conceptual art generally, coming out of Duchamp, they talk about, Duchamp likes to talk about retinal art that appeals to the eye, and the sort of pillars of that being, you know, line and color. And I think it is possible to talk about this work maybe within a retinal tradition. I mean, there is color. There's even, if you stare at it a while, besides the black and the red, there's some blue and there's some gray. And I think there's also line. These are hand-drawn numbers, so you could think about this as almost like a brush stroke or something like that. But I think pretty clearly it is also primarily dealing with the concept and why the fact these numbers might actually be here. at all and what they're doing and what kinds of equations are inside of the piece. If you read the little card here, you'll find out that Darboven, or at least the people who wrote the card, feel that Darboven is dealing here mostly with time. That is, that she's recording passages of daily rituals with these numbers. And I think that's true, and you can see it in a lot of her work, but I'm also kind of suspicious of the simplicity of that idea. Darboven, in all of her work, really works hard to keep her art pieces very overdetermined and elusive. And so I think there's probably more to it than just, you know, some sort of recording of the days. I think she's very aware that it's tough to read the equations and why the numbers are structured the way they're here, they are structured. I can tell you that, presuming this piece is like all her others, that the number strings don't really involve complex mathematical equations. What we're looking at is basic addition and multiplication, even though it's in a very complex pattern drawing from some kind of unknown source. And I think that that probably connects this piece more to bookkeeping, accounting, insurance, actuarial tables, which are the tables insurance companies have that tell you when you're going to die, and basically the way businesses use numbers rather than mathematicians. And I think nowadays a lot of us would grasp that fact a lot faster than we would in 1972 when this piece was made, because so many of us work with Excel files. And I think that if, you know, to me, the density of the top row and the density over here structures it a lot like a basic Excel spreadsheet, having rows and column headers and so forth. There are a lot of ways to think about these numbers, I think, besides, I mean, one way is they're like how businesses use it, how insurance companies use numbers. There's a critic named Dan Adler, following the critic Lucy Lippard, and she suggests that we think about, or he suggests through her, that we think about these numbers as coming from the world of childhood, a sort of obsessive, habitual, childish things like repetitions of songs, like row, row, row your boat, blackboard punishments, where you have to, you know, write things over and over, counting in foreign languages out loud until you learn them. So, you know, habitual, obsessive practices that are also, he suggests, similar in some ways to habits of the insane. And I'm going to come back to that near the end. A last thing that I was thinking you might think about as you look at this piece is that is this. Numbers are, we think of numbers, well, numbers are generally abstractions. You know, they stand for things in the real world like sticks or cows or shirts or whatever. And that's why they're useful. And meanwhile, most art pieces are also thought of as abstractions from some kind of experience. So in a way, we're looking at an abstraction of an abstraction. An abstraction, the art piece, is taking as its content another abstraction, a system of abstraction. And I think it's kind of second degree abstraction in that way. And I think that as a result, something very curious happens. The numbers become, instead of useful, which they always are, just kind of this stuff that's sitting here in the frame of this art piece. And I think that it makes us go back again to that question of why are these numbers here in a museum, and specifically back to that question of the hard sciences and the soft sciences, why they exist, and specifically why so many of us think of numbers as being practical, useful, objective, whereas we think of abstract systems of art as being subjective, personally expressive, and so forth. And yet both of them are cultural products that are engaged in abstracting procedures. So that's the broad question I want people to ponder if they are so inclined. And I'm going to open that up to by talking, you know, a few ways about the ways that numbers have shown up in the history of writing. And I'm going to go all the way back to the Greeks to start and just very, very rapidly and briefly mention that that there's a long tradition that I can't go into very long now. I mean, I could, but I don't have that kind of time. But I think of it as number as mystical revelation. Obviously, if you go far enough back in time, the line between religion and number and poetry becomes very, very faint and maybe invisible. So I went back to the 6th century BC and Pythagoras and the Pythagorean cult that existed then We're very focused on numbers and the mystical meaning of numbers, which I think is very different than we normally think about it today in our hard science, soft science division. So I thought to get us in the mood, I would read the prayer the Pythagoreans used to address to Tetractus, which is the holy fourfold. Here it is. Bless us, divine number, thou who generatest gods and men. O holy, holy Tetractus, thou that containest the root and the source of the eternally flowing creation. For the divine number begins with the profound, pure unity until it comes to the holy four. Then it begets the mother of all, the all-compromising, the all-bounding, the firstborn, the never-swerving, the never-tiring, holy ten, the keyholder of all. That's good echo in here for that. I'm not a terribly religious person, so I'm going to move quickly out of that area, but I will mention, you know, there's a long Jewish tradition where number is used mystically. I think a lot of people will be familiar with that from Gematria, where the Hebrew alphabet is numbered, and you can look at any word in Hebrew, and you can add all the numbers of the letters together. It becomes, and you can find mathematical meanings in various Hebrew writings. If you're familiar with the work of Madonna, her writings on this topic, then you'll know that you can research those a little bit. But I wanted to move on to the 20th century very quickly. Another way, I think it's very different from that way of using number in writing. I think of as number as multiplicity or involving ways that number suggests the social or the political. And I actually will go back to the Greeks. I read a lot in Greek history, so there are many other traditions besides the Greek that this stuff shows up in. But there's a famous dialogue of Plato's called the Parmenides, where he deals with the problem of the one and the many. And I think that dialogue, which continually focuses on contradictions between singularity and plurality, between parts and wholes, individual identity and group identity, is one place you can kind of see, in the history of philosophy anyway, this problem of the social problem of numbers and the way number interacts directly with socialness. I mean, I think a lot of people might remember, you know, the Socratic or the Platonic, you know, triangle and the circle and the perfection of those shapes and the way geometry shows up in those histories. But you know, a quick, simple example would be the way that, you know, we have a philosophical problem when a person becomes one rather than a fraction of one. So as they develop, when is a person a person? And these kinds of things have mathematical resonances as well in problems with singularity. And so a lot of that dialogue is concerned with these kinds of questions. And I wrote earlier in the summer on the Open Space blog a little bit about, I'm interested in the Gertrude Stein. I'm very obsessed with her writing, which is perfect for this pop-up poet series, which is kind of inspired by Stein. And I think that, I haven't found any direct connections, but I think she knew this Platonic dialogue probably pretty well, and I think there's a way that you can think about her being concerned with the social question of the one and the many, what it means to be among many people. I could argue, really, that all of her work, or a great deal of her work, is basically involved with the problem of the social, sort of the individual psyche entangled with otherness and trying to figure itself out in relation to that. Earlier this summer, they read The Makings of Americans, and I think it's shot all through that book. One of her favorite words is one in that book, and comes back to it again and again. And I thought I'd read a little piece from that book just for a taste of the way Stein uses number to stress our embeddedness in social existence, problems of social knowledge. There were a lot of examples I could find, but this is from The Making of Americans. Each one is coming gradually to be known in their living what way being is completely inside in men, in women, when they are quite young ones, completely little ones, older ones, middle-aged ones, old ones. Then each one comes gradually to be knowing how being is in men, in women, when women are about 60, about 50, about 55, about 40, about 45, about 30, about 28, about 26, about 22, about 18 and 14 and 11, and 7 and 5 and 2 and 3 and 2 and under 1, to being only just beginning, being, and living. Each one gradually in living is realizing how being is in men, how being is in women at different ages in them. Each one comes in living to know more differences than just very young living, middle living, and old living. Again and again, it is a startling thing to someone to be learning pieces of this thing, of the way being is at different ages in men and in women. I am just now a little realizing how old men and how old women mostly are when they are 61. I have learned a good deal about how being is in men between 33 and 42. I know a good deal about 27, 25, 29, 30, 32, 34, 37, 40, and 42. And then I know a little about 57. And now I am learning something about being in men and women when they are 60 and 61. I know a good deal about them when they are very little ones, 2 and 3 years old, in living. Something about them when they are 11. A very little about them when they are 17. Almost nothing when they are 18 and 15. I know a very little about them when they are 21. So being a social, I'm going to skip ahead to sort of the third and last thing I want to talk about, which is I'm kind of calling it number as limit case or particularly around the question of infinity. And I'm going to read a little bit from a poem of my own. I've got a book called Journey of the Sun that's about to come out. And it's an epic poem where the narrator describes a trip that he took to the sun when he was 13 years old. And I'm going to read all the poems are actually have numbers in the title. This one's called Division 3, Section 1. A writer is never an expert. And so we must practice, and so we must learn. You know it will be painful in time, in money, in mistakes, and in pain, but most of all in poetry. I was young and asked directly what makes such tables, such countrysides, such suspension bridges really. The force of forces, said George, is split into these respectively, copies, beings, things, and fantasies, plus movement, so technically 5. 2 being primary, 3 secondary, each possessed of 2 inclinations, the irascible and the concupiscible, which the Thomists further divide into 11, 6 of the coveting, and 5 of the evading. Per consequence, by association, we arrive at the one true answer, 264 upper, 176 lower, 44 transitive, me grims, 9 decillion eyes in rapid fire, something. Okay, so what do I think is going on? It's hard to talk about one's own poem, but I think it might be sort of healthy a little bit. I can say in part I'm borrowing from, and maybe it's not completely visible in this poem, but I'm borrowing from a tradition of the writings of the insane, and they have a habit, of course, using very large numbers, obsessive sort of categorical divisions and to express their experiences. And also the whole idea of a trip to the sun is obviously pretty crazy, so you could say that mental illness is a sub-theme in the book. And to tie it back to Darboven briefly, too, I thought I would briefly quote something that Lucy Lippert said about this repetitive nature of Darboven's work and artists like her, which is that they, quote, saturate the outwardly sane and didactic premises, their outwardly sane and didactic premises, with a poetic and condensatory intensity that almost amounts to insanity. But I think there's that, and then I also was, there are multiple ways that I was thinking about number in this book. I used it a lot, and I think that the main reason that I was using numbers there and the main reason I was thinking about it, especially the large numbers, has to do with the way they can suggest infinity and philosophical complexity that's connected to infinity. The book tries to think about the sun, which immediately means thinking about the entirety of human existence, both spatially and temporally. And to articulate this a little bit more, I want to, if I have time, go into the mathematical portion of the evening. So if you're not a mathematician, but I'm going to go, I don't think it'll be too painful, I'll go quickly. But there's a number theorist named Tobias Danzig, and he has something that I'd like to quote about the assertion that the number sequence is infinite. Okay? I know you're not a lot of non-mathematicians here, but the idea that the number sequence never ends, this assertion does not impose itself as the only one conceivable. For its opposite, the postulation of a finite series of number leads to a bounded arithmetic, which is just as tenable. This assertion is not derived from the immediate experience of our senses, for all our experience proclaims its falsity. And finally, this assertion of infinity is not a consequence of the historical development of the experiential sciences, for all the latest evidence points to a bounded universe. And in the light of the latest discoveries in the structure of the atom, the infinite divisibility of matter must also be declared a myth. And yet, the concept of infinity, though not imposed upon us by logic or by experience, is a mathematical necessity. Why is it a mathematical necessity for Danzig, as he's explaining elsewhere in that book? It's because infinity proves the universal validity of even really very basic properties, mathematical properties, properties down in addition and subtraction, things like the associative and the communicative properties. Some of you are flashing back to fourth grade. You remember those? So the very basis of mathematics, the proof that these things that we believe about them at the levels of 1, 2, and 3 are true, depends on the belief in an infinite number series, which cannot be in any way established on any of these levels. So to me, it suggests something, and I was aware of this sort of basic philosophical idea when I started writing the book. The level of local logic, 1, 2, and 3 is always contingent upon presumptions we're making about that. Farthest logic. And for me, I think that conveys, moves into sort of social questions as well. A lot of the general truth value of sort of local, philosophical, political, environmental, ethical beliefs are, in my view, dependent on some really gigantic, extensive conceptions that we have about the end of civilization and some imaginary future, about its beginnings, about the cosmos in time and space, as well as presumptions about the infinitely small, the quantum. I think that our belief about cavemen, and what they were like, or about, colonizing space, which is something that I'm also interested in, things that seem to us to be in the realm of really pure speculation are actually buried down in the midst of our views about pesticides and immigration and the shooting of Kenneth Harding by San Francisco PD last week. I mean, I think that those things have this connection, and that connection is that the local has this universal significance at all points. And really, I guess the point is that nothing is irrelevant. The world is everything that is the case, and also nothing is established beyond. Everything could change. Our belief about whether this or that small local act is just has to do with such large unprovable assumptions that actually all social structures could alter if we came up with a different kind of proof or a different understanding of the infinite and the infinitely large. So this is just to say this. Maybe I'm making a fairly articulate case, I don't know. But it is very hard to talk about one's own writing. I just want to say as well that when I was writing this, I gave myself kind of an infinite freedom, and I'm trying to sort of retroactively figure out why all this crazy number talk showed up in the poems, and just so nobody thinks that I sat down and read Tobias Danzig and then proceeded to write a long poem. But anyway, so that's all I got. I'm going to end with a poem by a man named Byrne Porter to go to kind of the extreme end of this idea about numbers and writing. And it's one of the, I looked for basically a poem that was made up entirely of numbers or almost entirely of numbers. Byrne Porter has a book of found poems that came out very recently. He would find things on the street or in various places and had a little paste pot and would glue them together. He's a pretty interesting character. He's been dead for a little while, but it's nice to see this book come out. And I think that there are a lot of people who work in this area of visual poetry and found poetry, and collage and so forth. But I think he does a particularly good job of it. And this is an untitled poem, and I thank you very, very much for your attention. Six, 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 10A, six, 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 10A, 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 10B, 10B, seven, 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 10B, eight, 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 comma, 10B, eight, 10B, 9, 9, 10B, 9, 10B, 10C, 10C, 9, 9, 9, 9, 10, 10, 10C, 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 10C. Thank you very much.